Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm Bob McChesney, your host. Today we're going to be talking about the internet. And we're very privileged to have as our guest one of the really outstanding authorities on the past, present, and future of the internet, a law professor from Stanford University, Lawrence Lessig. Larry Lessig has written a couple of really seminal works on the internet. The first book that came to my attention, Code and Other Laws of Cyberspace, was published by Basic Books in 1999. More recently, and perhaps with even more acclaim, his 2001 book, The Future of Ideas, The Fate of the Commons in a Connected World. Lawrence Lessig, thank you very much for joining us today in Media Matters.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's really great to have you here. Now, this is a general interest show, Larry, so I don't think we should assume our listeners really are experts on the internet, its history, or know much about it. So let's start with a few basics, if we can. Did Al Gore invent the internet? Is that true?
Well, that's certainly not true in the sense that he invented the basic protocols that built this neutral platform for innovation and creativity. But there is something, I think, that is true in what Gore said, and that is that the government originally took a very strong role in pushing the development of a network that was not privileged to one proprietary platform or one type of content provider, but instead was a general neutral platform that would facilitate all sorts of innovation and creativity being built on top of it. The government did that. Al Gore wasn't there at the start of that, but he certainly had at his core an idea about building that network.
So Al Gore had more to do with inventing the internet, say, than Bill Gates.
Well, I'm sure that Al Gore was happier about the internet than Bill Gates was initially. There's this famous memo that Bill Gates writes in 1995, basically announcing that the internet is the greatest threat to Microsoft that Microsoft had ever seen, and reorienting the company towards a strategy that would protect itself against the potential threat of the internet. So they certainly initially were quite fearful of the internet. But I think now Microsoft actually has a stronger business interest in a neutral internet platform than any major software provider out there. And so in some sense, though the internet was Microsoft's enemy in the beginning, it right now I think is at the core of its future and its future growth.
I want to get to that point later because that seems to be somewhat of a change, perhaps, in the Microsoft strategy from the 90s when the fear was that they were trying to sort of colonize the internet with their proprietary software. But before we get to that, let's just back up again and go to this history of the internet, where it came from, because the point you made, which is the public sector was, you know, decisive in getting this off the ground and subsidizing and creating it. And that, like Microsoft, other private sector interests weren't as immediately captivated by the principle of the internet. The story I've heard, and I've seen it cited a couple of times, maybe even one of your books, is that AT&T was at one time approached, I think in the 70s, by the government and asked if they'd take a larger role in managing the predecessor to the internet. And they studied it and said, we can't figure out how to make money off of this thing. No, thank you. Is that a true story?
Well, it's certainly true that from the very beginning, people who had an idea to build a network that was very close to the internet were resisted by the by AT&T. I tell the story in The Future of Ideas about one of the founders to the conception of a network that would become the internet, a man named Paul Baran, who was in the early 60s, 1964, working for the RAND Corporation, and RAND was advising the Defense Department on ways to make communication technologies more secure in the event of a nuclear war. And Baran came up with the idea of a technology which was redundant and what we now call packet switching technologies, meaning you take a communication, you chop it up into little packets, you then spew those packets out onto the network in any number of different ways, and then collect them at the other end. And by doing it in this way, you could assure that if any particular path was lost, if any connection or link went down, the packets could travel on a different path, and so therefore the system would be redundant and capable to deal with massive loss, and which is exactly what we would expect in the context of a war. So Baran had this idea, and the Defense Department loved it. The Defense Department took it to AT&T at the time. And AT&T, remember, at this time was a government-backed monopoly that had exclusive rights to develop technologies for the communications system. And AT&T's response to this, as reported, was first that this technology would never possibly work, and second, even if it did work, AT&T was damned if they would allow the creation of a competitor to itself, which is they were not going to permit innovation that would produce a network that was uncontrollable by AT&T. And so they resisted it at that point. They resisted it in the 1970s. And all the way up into the mid-1990s, the very head of AT&T viewed the Internet as a toy, as just a hobby for the equivalent of ham radio operators or CB radio operators, not the mainstay of business. And this is because these large network companies have almost in their constitution, but certainly in their culture, this idea that control is the only way to build a stable, solid communications infrastructure. They have to control how it develops, and if they don't control how it develops, then the system won't be robust or reliable. But the Internet has proved exactly the opposite. It's only when the network lost control over how the technology would develop, when the original protocols of the network made the network irrelevant in some sense to how it would grow, that we saw the most dynamic and stable development of a network that that eventually became what we thought of as the Internet.
Now, there are, in the public sector, during the 70s and 80s, there really are two cultures that get brought up in the Internet's history. One is, which you've already alluded to, is the military culture, the need of the defense establishment to have this new technology, which would make it much more easy to communicate during wartime. And the second is the research university component, the computer scientists and engineers working at major research universities like the University of Illinois, where we are here. And they're sort of a very collaborative culture that developed around the Internet. And I think for those old-timers of us who remember the ancient history of 10, 12, 15 years ago, a very different culture than we would associate with the Internet by the mid to late 1990s. In your view, I mean, where does the credit go, or where should the emphasis go to understand the prehistory of the Internet? Should it go at the defense side? Should it go at the research university computer science side? What's your view of that, Larry?
Well, I think the important first step is not to simplify these cultures too much. It's certainly true that the military is filled with characters that, you know, might be in, films from the 1960s and their sort of obsessive mentality to control the world.
You're thinking of Dr. Strangelove,
yeah,
it sounds
Dr.
like?
Yeah, Dr. Strangelove, right. But the military also was filled with people who looked at the emerging telecommunications and computing architecture and said, why are we so fundamentally dependent upon these fundamentally incompatible technologies, right? They would go to computer companies like Data General or IBM, and they would buy computers that were completely incapable of talking to each other. And they were incapable of talking to each other because these proprietary computer companies believed that the best way to protect their profit was to develop systems that were completely non-communicative. So it was what one person has referred to as the autistic stage of computing, where you have these very smart machines, but machines that can't in any sense communicate with each other. The Defense Department said, we're spending millions of dollars on technology every year that can't even connect, and we're tired of it. So the military said, we want to develop a network technology that makes these systems fundamentally communicative, so they could begin to talk to each other. And that's where the Defense Department started pushing research in the DARPA unit that would enable communication among computers. Now, on the other side, we have this very rosy picture of the research institutions loving to collaborate and loving to share their ideas. But the fact is, at the very beginning, research institutions resisted as strongly as they could this intercommunication network. In fact, it took the Defense Department many years to realize that they would have to actually force research institutions to begin to deploy this technology before they would deploy it. So they initially made grants conditional upon the research institutions adopting and deploying the original technologies that gave birth to the Internet. So initially, the research institutions, too, were relatively proprietary, but the government forced them to open themselves up. And then very quickly, the culture that you described becomes the dominant culture, where researchers recognize that if they can begin to share computing resources around the world, they can actually produce a lot more interesting research than they could if they depended upon their own proprietary autistic computing system. So the government pushed, research institutions picked it up, and very quickly this culture of sharing and creativity became to dominate the original vision of what the Internet is. Now, I completely agree with you. That vision of the Internet has no connection to what the Internet is increasingly becoming, and it's increasingly becoming this because the original proprietary interests, which built these autistic computers that couldn't talk to each other, are once again attempting to impose that attitude on the network.
We're talking to Larry Lessig today, professor of law at Stanford University on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, and our phone lines are open if anyone would like to call in and ask Professor Lessig a question. The numbers are 333-9455, and our toll-free number, 800-222-9455. As I said, the lines are open. Feel free to call in. You know, Larry, what I want to talk to you about for much of the show is exactly what you just referred to, the problems, the barriers to the Internet sort of fulfilling its what might be regarded as its promise. But before we do talk about that, just briefly, though, to give a sense of what that promise is. I mean, in an ideal world, in a world where powerful special interests couldn't distort or shape the Internet to suit their needs, what could the Internet look like in our society 5, 10, 15, 20 years down the road? And what is there that's worth fighting for?
Well, that's a very hard question to answer.
Well, that's why I asked you.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure I even have an answer. And the reason is that you've got to really believe in the potential for innovation to surprise us. And by definition, then, I can't point to the surprises that are going to be produced. But we learn something about this if we look at the past and the history of the Internet, right? Think about the most important innovations that gave birth to the Internet. First of all, the basic protocols themselves, TCP/IP. These were protocols developed by a bunch of research students, graduate students, working in collaboration in the late 1960s, early 1970s. The World Wide Web was developed not by network owners, but not by AT&T. It was developed at a research lab in Switzerland, right? ICQ, which was one of the first peer-to-peer instant messaging systems, was developed not by AOL, but developed by an Israeli whose father then took it and turned it into a $400 million company that he sold to AOL. HTML mail, webmail, originally called, the first version of it was Hotmail, was developed not by Microsoft, but developed by an Indian immigrant who had the idea and then deployed it in a way that took off in the fastest growing network we had before Napster. And then there's Napster, which was developed by a couple of kids in a dorm room as a peer-to-peer technology to enable file sharing technology to deploy. Now, the constant feature of all of those innovations is that they are kids and non-Americans, right? They're outsiders to the dominant owners of the network. And this is not an accident. It's not, you know, some fortuity of history. It is because the original Internet was architected to guarantee that outsiders would constantly have the right to bring their ideas, in some sense, to the marketplace of the Internet. And the Internet would run them. You wouldn't have to get the permission of the network owner to be able to deploy your new ideas. So I think when you look at that history and then you turn around and imagine it going forward, you recognize that if we preserve the original values of the Internet, this neutral platform for innovation, then we continue to have an extraordinary range of surprises about how this network could connect to our lives and give us services that all of us find indispensable once we learn of them, in ways that are not likely to be produced by, you know, the largest dominant network providers, whether that's network providers as in telecoms like AT&T or network providers as in large media companies who, you know, have a very strong interest in protecting their existing way of doing business. So I see it as protecting an environment where anybody can innovate and create and let the market pick which innovations and creativity it wants, and avoiding an environment where large vested interests have the power through law and technology to protect themselves against new innovation.
We're talking to Larry Lessig again, and if you'd like to call in, our phone lines are 333-9455, 800-222-9455. We've got a caller right now, Larry. Let's go to the phone lines. Champagne, you're on the air with Lawrence Lessig.
Hi. I've got a question. You were talking earlier about this rather sharing, liberty-minded focus of the Internet, and I've recently become interested in the free software movement, which has a similar focus. And I was wondering if you could talk about the free software movement and its focus on individual liberties and being able to share freely.
I'd love to. In fact, there's a intimate connection between the growth of the Internet and the growth of what was originally called the free software movement, and then it branched out, and there's a version of it called the open source software movement right now. But both of these movements initially recognized the extraordinary importance in making resources, the fundamental resources of the network, available to others so that they could build on those resources and make them better. So the Free Software Foundation was founded by a man named Richard Stallman, who was a researcher at MIT. And Richard Stallman was extraordinarily frustrated as increasingly commercial providers, in the initial case it was of printer driver technology, forbid him from getting access to the source code so that he could modify the source code and make it better for MIT. And he started a foundation that was committed to the idea that the source code to software should remain free for other people to take and build upon as they want to develop the network or software programs as they wish, and that this was a crucial component of freedom in a digital age because, as I've written, increasingly we should think about the architecture or the code of cyberspace as a kind of law. Well, many years before I came, I began to talk about that. The Free Software Foundation was out there saying exactly the same thing, that this technology would increasingly regulate and control our life, and as a minimum, just as with a free society, we should have access to the basic systems of control that free software constitutes, and be allowed to modify and change it. Now, they initially developed some of the most important software that the network was built upon, Unix, which was the original. It was actually a creation of AT&T, and here again we want to understand that cultures are always mixed. Within Bell Labs at AT&T, researchers were trying to develop an operating system, which Unix eventually was, that would work on many different computers, and that's what the original design of Unix was for. Because AT&T was banned by the government from getting into the computer business, they made that that original operating system available for many people to take and build upon. Not free in the sense that the Free Software Foundation does, but still free in the sense that many people could deploy and develop it in ways that they chose. And that freedom gave birth to many of the technologies that eventually formed the interconnections of the network. So the original web services that got built into the Apache web server is, in this sense, a free software project. Most of the email that still travels on the Internet gets sent in through a protocol or a set of technologies called sendmail technologies that are free software technologies. The vast majority of web servers in the world run on free software, the Apache server. And the fastest growing operating system out there is the GNU Linux operating system, which is an operating system that was born with Richard Stallman's efforts to develop a free operating system, and then completed in its initial sense with a kernel provided by a Finn named Linus Torvalds that we think of as the Linux kernel. So this history has a parallel history. The history of the Internet has a parallel history of technologists defending the right and the ability for people to take and build upon other work in a free and sharing sense, And the thing to recognize about this is not, you know, a form of communism. This is a kind of sharing that enabled the greatest innovation and growth both for commercial and non-commercial entities alike. So the caller is exactly right. This is a crucial part of the history that I think our modern proprietary way of thinking sometimes obscures.
It sounds, though, Larry, that there's actually been tremendous advances, though, in the open source movement recently to hear you talk. I mean, that it has not been crushed. If anything, it's blossoming. Is that fair to say?
Well, at the moment, that's right. And I think some of the most exciting work that's going on in the Internet is work that's supported in this more open way. And this is not just, you know, the Free Software Foundation or open source software, but Real Networks, for example, announced a protocol that would be an open protocol for facilitating media sharing on the network, which I think is an encouraging step. And Apple's latest operating system, OS X, has built within it the kernel of a version of the early free Unix systems, BSD Unix, which is also an encouraging sign. But I think that the danger with open source and free software right now is on the horizon, as software patents will increasingly make it hard for these movements to negotiate the legal regulations that patents impose. And that's the great danger for the future of these operating systems.
We're talking to Lawrence Lessig, professor of law at Stanford University and author of two outstanding recent books on the Internet, The Future of Ideas, Encode and Other Laws of Cyberspace Today and Media Matters. If you'd like to call in and ask a question to Larry Lessig, the number is 333-9455 or our toll-free number, 800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone line. Urbana, you're on the air with Professor Lessig.
Yeah, that last point that you made about the future economics of the Internet is really kind of troubling. But I think there'll always be a pirate segment of it, which will keep a certain ethos going. But I wanted to ask about, in general, repression of websites by governments, either internationally or within countries. I was wondering if you could speak about that a little bit. You hear a lot about how Cuba keeps their people away from the Internet, but just in general, what's going on in that area, and does it look like it's on a downslide or what? No, hang up. Thank you.
Thank you. That's a great question.
It is a great question. It is certainly true that governments are increasingly able to filter Internet activity in a way that makes the Internet more and more like the way real world was before, so that the Chinese government can use these technologies to block out anti-Chinese speech, and the French government can use these technologies to mandate that, for example, Yahoo not permit any Nazi paraphernalia to be controlled on its site. These are all changes in the technology that enable greater control. Now, I think the interesting thing about these changes is that they're not really changes that the government has produced. One of the arguments that I make in my first book, Code, is that a lot of these changes, the ability to control and filter content on the Internet, come from commercial entities who are trying to make the Internet more compatible to their own vision of how to do business. Mm-hmm. So some of the technologies enable Internet providers to identify who people are and where they come from. That's a useful way for them to begin to market to people differently or make content available differently depending on who you are or where you come from. And the point is then that the very same technologies that make commerce work better can also be used by governments to make government regulation work better. And we in the United States are no exception to this rule. There was a big stir around the Internet when France blocked out Yahoo content because Yahoo had Nazi material available on their sites, and the French government said, you have to guarantee that French citizens won't get access to this Nazi paraphernalia before we're going to allow you to carry it on your site, even though it was an American company. But the United States has done the same thing with copyright law. For example, there was a Canadian company called iCrave TV. iCrave TV had free television streamed across the Internet. According to the law at the time, that was a legal thing to do in Canada, to stream rebroadcast television across any medium, including the Internet. But in the United States, that rebroadcasting violated copyright law. So a Pittsburgh court, at the behest of the NFL, ordered the Canadian site to be shut down until the Canadian site developed technologies to perfectly block out United States citizens from getting access to that content. So the point is, with respect to copyright law, the United States is no different from the Chinese with respect to their own content law, or the French with respect to their own content law. Every government will have content that it wants to control and insist on technologies that enable ISPs to exercise that control. And that's why we're seeing, as I wrote about in Code, this increasing zoning of the Internet and increasingly turning the Internet not from this space of free exchange of ideas, but increasingly into a space where governments and commercial entities can control who you, where you go and what you get access to.
You know, in Code, since you referred to it, there's a discussion there that I found very compelling, because I think most Americans, when you think of regulation, social regulation of activity, you think in terms of government regulation, of laws, of censorship. And I think what you talked about in there is that actually there are lots of ways. In fact, you outlined four main ways that a society can regulate social behavior. In laws, government regulation is just one of those four. And that when you think in the broader terms, you can get a much better sense of how the Internet is being regulated, even if you don't necessarily have an explicit commissar censoring websites. Can you just briefly explain that?
Right. Well, this is actually an insight that I think that Mill, John Stuart Mill, originally made famous. Mill wrote a book in the 19th century called On Liberty, and one of his concerns was the lack of free speech within England. But he wasn't worried that the English government was censoring speech. What he was worried about was that social norms in England made it so the English were terrified to say anything that wasn't strictly proper within the context of the English society. And his argument was that that stifling effect of social norms actually reduced free speech within England. Now, the insight there is to say we should think not just about the way governments restrict freedom, but also think about the way social norms might restrict freedom, or the market might, in certain contexts, restrict freedom, or the very architecture within which we live, the kind of physical environment, might restrict freedom. And also recognize that the government, in its efforts to regulate society, doesn't just operate directly by passing laws that tell you how to behave, but it also regulates indirectly by passing laws that try to change social norms, or by passing laws that try to affect the way the market functions, and by passing laws that affect the physical way that we experience reality. So, you know, the government's campaigns against smoking, fortunately in my view, have had the effect of stigmatizing smokers. Government's campaigns to raise the price of cigarettes by taxing cigarettes have had the effect of using the market to reduce the consumption of cigarettes. And government's efforts at regulating the very way in which cigarettes are made has the effect of changing the addictiveness of cigarettes, and therefore using the architecture of cigarettes to change the consumption of cigarettes. This is the way modern regulation works all the time. Governments think about these different ways to change behavior and then try to regulate to affect those different ways. Now, this is an important distinction or understanding to have when you think about cyberspace, because cyberspace is primarily an architecture in this sense. I mean, your freedoms in cyberspace are defined by the code or the software that makes cyberspace the way it is. And the obvious thing about that is that the code or software or architecture of cyberspace could be changed. In fact, it could be changed by commerce, as commerce wants to make it a more commercial-friendly place, or it could be changed by governments, as governments want to make it a more government-friendly place. And that the story I was telling in Code is that if you just worry about government regulating you directly, you'll miss the ways in which government and commerce are changing the architecture of cyberspace to remove lots of the freedoms and liberty that cyberspace originally protected.
We're talking to Lawrence Lessig today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We have a couple phone lines open. The number is 333-9455, or our toll-free number, 800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines now. Champagne, you're on the air with Larry Lessig.
Yes, I have a kind of a two-part question. Some of this comes from a column that was on the BBC website just last Friday, which talked about how a new decision in the European Union was following along guidelines which this writer, an Englishman, regarded as copying the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, and he spoke very disapprovingly of what effect that would have on English copyright considerations. And so the first part of the question has to do with the extent to which decisions about law are really being made outside of governmental contexts in which we currently work, such as the European Union or the World Trade Organization. And the second one has to do with a part of a point that this writer for the BBC raised, how, with all the great benefits that you identify as being with the Internet, how things can be structured so that there's both the openness and some protection for the copyright owners, the authors, and others who benefit from that side of copyright. I'll hang up and listen.
You know, Larry, before you answer that directly, maybe this is the good time for you to just briefly give a little background on copyright, its history, the values and principles involved, sort of the balance involved, so our listeners get a sense of what the terrain is for the current debate over copyright.
Yeah, that's a great point. And the question, I think, raises a critical issue that's at the core of what's happening to the Internet right now. Obviously, copyright, which is has long-standing history in the United States and around the world, is an extremely important part of the creative process. If we didn't have copyright, then artists would have to depend upon patronage from the state or from rich people, and that would make a much less diverse and interesting culture. So copyright's an important part of what makes creativity possible. But historically, our framers, at least, have always understood, and our tradition has always respected, that the protections of copyright are to be balanced against an equally important free speech interest in making sure that cultural material is available to other people to build upon and criticize and get access to. So in the United States, copyright is expressly granted to the Congress in the original Constitution, but that grant of authority expressly says that copyrights must be for, quote, limited times, meaning after a certain period of time, the copyright must expire and the works that were created pass into a public domain, where anybody can take them and do with them as they wish.
Now, if I can just interject for one thing, what we mean by copyright, just for people who might not follow this at all, is giving the creator monopoly rights over the production of their good for a certain period of time. No one else can print their book or play their music. Is that right?
Well, originally it was just that. So the original copyright law said you couldn't republish somebody else's map, chart, and book for 14 years. But the original copyright law didn't control what we'd now call derivative use of the work. So if you had a play, you could perform it without the permission of the copyright owner. If you had a book, you could translate it without the permission of the copyright owner. You could make an abridgment of the book without the permission of the copyright owner. You could do all sorts of things to it. As Apple Computer would say, you could rip, mix, and burn it without permission of the original copyright owner. But copyright law in the last 200 years has radically increased, expanded, so that it's now not just controlling copies of the original work, but it's also giving the copyright owner power to control derivative uses of the work. And you know, one very famous example that I think brings this up is the young Alan Simpson, who would later become a United States senator, originally during World War II translated Hitler's Mein Kampf and wanted to publish that translation in English because he believed that the translation that Hitler had authorized wasn't accurate to what the book originally said. So he translates Mein Kampf and he tries to publish it, and he's stopped by the copyright owners from publishing this more accurate translation because copyright law by the 20th century controlled not just copies of the original work but also derivative works as well. Or more recently, there's a woman, Alice Randall, who wrote a book called The Wind Ungone, which was in some sense a takeoff on Margaret Mitchell's Gone with the Wind. It tells the story of Gone with the Wind, but from the perspective of African slaves. And as you might expect, they had a very different view of Tara and the antebellum South than Margaret Mitchell did. But when she went to publish that book, her publisher was greeted with a lawsuit by the Margaret Mitchell estate, because the Margaret Mitchell estate says, we own Gone with the Wind, you're writing a sequel to it, we don't give you permission to write a sequel to it, therefore stop your publication and burn all the existing copies of the books.
But Larry, I'm confused. Didn't Margaret Mitchell die like 100 years ago or 50 years ago?
Right. Her book was published in 1936, and under the original copyright law existing in 1936, it should have passed into the public domain in 1992. But because Congress has gotten into this habit of extending the term of existing copyrights, which they've done 11 times in the last 40 years, copyrights, in this sense, you know, continue forever. So we continually have the extension of copyrights, and these works don't pass into the public domain anymore. And so that means that the opportunity for people to criticize or build upon earlier work is increasingly reduced. I mean, my favorite example of this type of hypocrisy is Walt Disney, right? I mean, Walt Disney, the creator, is, in my view, a hero of American culture, right? He produced some of the most creative and interesting work. But all of his early creations are creations that build upon work that either was in the public domain or was takeoff of work that was copyrighted. You know, Snow White, all of the Grimm fairy tales are retold by the Disney Corporation in a beautiful and wonderfully creative way, but still they depend upon the public domain for their livelihood, right? Well, now this continual extension of copyright, which some people refer to as the Mickey Mouse Protection Acts, basically mean that nobody can do to the Disney Corporation what Walt Disney did to the Brothers Grimm, because work doesn't pass into the public domain in the way that it did before, so that you can't build upon work in the free, unrestrained way that Walt Disney did. Now, that's an example, I think, of the way that an originally balanced system for protecting artists' creativity has increasingly been distorted and is increasingly viewed not as a balance between incentives and access, but instead an almost perfect property right for artists and increasingly media conglomerates to control the way in which our culture is developed.
And Larry, I mean, what about our elected representatives? Aren't they looking out for our interests in these matters?
Well, you know, the short answer, as I'm sure your question knows, is no.
That's called a rhetorical question, Larry.
Yeah. Rhetorical question. And the reason for this is, you know, elected representatives aren't bad people, but they respond to the lobbyists who are knocking at their door. And the lobbyists who knock at their door are, you know, increasingly concentrated media who is interested in preserving their control over the development of our culture. Now, the original caller's question related to something called the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which I think is an extraordinary example of this overreaching. The Digital Millennium Copyright Act says if a copyright owner uses a technology to protect their copyrighted work, the technology being a copy protection technology, then if you circumvent that technology to release the work from copyright protection, you've committed a violation of the DMCA, whether or not the purpose for your circumvention would have been protected as traditional fair use. So if you're a blind person and you circumvent a copy protection technology that makes it so you can't read an electronic book aloud, you still violated the DMCA, even though your use of the copyrighted work is a completely legitimate fair use. Now, the DMCA is an American law, but it was passed pursuant to an international treaty which mandates that all countries who are signatories of the treaty pass an equivalent to the DMCA. And I think that was a very good insight in the questioner's original question, which was that these international treaties are increasingly being pushed in international fora that don't have any direct connection to ordinary democracies. So when the United States in the Clinton administration found it hard to get extremely copy protective laws passed, they would go to WIPO, the World Intellectual Property Organization, and get them to recommend these as part of international treaties. They would be adopted as treaties, and then the Clinton administration will come back to the United States and say, see, well, now the international law is making us do it. But I think these are increasingly end runs around the democratic process, and especially when they're at the bidding of these very strong commercial interests who don't have an interest in balance but have an interest in maximum control, ordinary democratic participants should be increasingly concerned.
And just to lay it out clearly for us, why is this important for the Internet? Why is copyright emerging as such a central issue in the future of the Internet?
Well, it's really for unintended reasons, right? Before the Internet, there were a million ways you could use a copyrighted work that were completely unregulated by the copyright law, right? So when you read a book, this was not a fair use of the book. This was an unregulated use of the book because it involved no copying. When you lent it to somebody, you could lend it because there was no copying involved. When you sold it, you could sell it free of the copyright law because copyright law was explicitly limited so that it only covered the first sale of the book. You could do all of these things unregulated by copyright law because the technology before the Internet meant that all of this was done without copying. Now, enter the Internet. Absolutely everything you do on the Internet is a copy, right? That's the architecture of the technology. When you read a e-book, the reading of the book copies a version of it from the disk drive somewhere into your memory. That's a copy. When you give it to somebody else, you're making a copy and then giving it to somebody else. So all of these activities now involve this root activity called copying. And in a lawyer's completely legalistic way, what that's meant is that copyright lawyers have increasingly said, basically all of these uses of copyrighted works on the Internet are now regulated by copyright law, which means copyright law becomes the fundamental regulation of activity on the Internet. Now, in my view, copyright law was never intended to be the massive regulator of creativity that it is right now. It certainly wasn't intended by our framers as that. But it even wasn't intended by people who passed copyright laws in the 1970s before the emergence of this network. But the consequence of the technology of the Internet right now is that increasingly copyright law is controlled by this technology, and this technology gives copyright owners more and more control over how their works get used.
We're talking to Larry Lessig today on Media Matters. We've got about 10 minutes to go, and we've got a couple of phone lines open. We're going to take about a couple callers who have been very patient and waiting, and we're going to go to them. But if you do want to call, the numbers again, 333-9455, and our toll-free number, 800-222-9455. Champagne, you're on the air with Larry Lessig.
Thank you. I kind of wanted to follow up on the Wind Done Gone case, which I thought was just, you know, one of the most egregious attempts to suppress artistic expression. But I believe that actually the author did win the right to publish pretty much based on First Amendment.
Yeah, that's exactly right. But, you know, what lawyers don't like to remind the world about is that that process of winning the right to speak
is horrendous.
Extraordinarily expensive.
Yeah.
So they had to litigate this case in a federal district court. The judge wrote a 50-page opinion, which, you know, I read and thought wasn't crazy, that held that the work was infringing. And then it had to go to the Court of Appeals. They had to file an appellate brief and then write in the Court of Appeals. And finally, the Court of Appeals came down on the side of saying that this should be free. But the very fact that in order to write a story that criticizes a classic in American history required that you go to a court and get the permission of the court shows the sense in which copyright law infringes on our traditional conceptions of free speech. Free speech is not about having the right to speak if you can go convince a court to let you. Free speech should be about the right to speak freely. And so you're right that this case was decided correctly, but, you know, I'm quite confident that the next time an author has a work that's critical of a mainstay of American culture that's still under copyright, it's going to be hard to find the publisher who's willing to take the risk that they won't be drawn into court and forced to justify their publication. My own book, I had the same issue. I quoted this wonderful story by Courtney Love, who wrote this article in Salon magazine about the record industry and how the record industry is strongly against the interest of artists. And I quoted a fairly lengthy passage in the book. My publisher came to me and says, "Well, we have a rule that says you can't quote more than 50 words or 10% of an article, whichever is less. So you've quoted too much, and you have to cut the quote." And I said to the publisher, "Well, look, this is clearly fair use." And they said, "We don't care about fair use. We have our rules, and we have our rules because we don't want to be dragged into court to defend the right to publish what we publish, because that's going to be too expensive. So therefore, either cut it or buy permission to use it, but either way, we're not going to let you publish this without complying with our rules." So that means the publishers become more conservative than the law, and that means the law has a much more dramatic effect on free speech than the appellate decisions make it sound like it does.
All right, well, let's go to another caller now. Urbana, you're on the air with Larry Lessig.
Yeah, hey, Larry. The BBC has been running a series on Silicon Valley, and they've really been blasting Stanford. But the important point is, tell me what you know about Sonny Bono and the politics of the Sonny Bono copyright law here, and I'll hang up and listen.
Well, I know a lot more about this than any sensible person should, because, in fact, right this minute, I'm writing the brief for the Supreme Court to argue why the Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act is unconstitutional. Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act was passed in 1998, extending the term of copyrights by another 20 years.
Basically, nothing new would come into the public domain for 20 more years.
That's right. When it was introduced, Mary Bono, Sonny's wife, said that Sonny believed the copyright term should be forever, but the lawyers told her there would be a constitutional problem with that. So she suggested that they follow Jack Valenti's proposal of forever minus a day.
Jack Valenti is the head of the Motion Picture Trade Organization.
Right. MPAA, right. So the Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act was filed, and within 3 weeks, we at Harvard Berkman Center filed a lawsuit on behalf of a guy named Eric Eldred and a bunch of other plaintiffs who depend upon the public domain for their livelihood. They basically take work, they make it available on the Internet, or they publish it, like Dover Press publishes public domain works. And they basically said, we've been stopped for 20 years from doing what we do because of this Copyright Term Extension Act, and that Extension Act is unconstitutional because the Constitution says terms are supposed to be limited. Now, the government's response is, you know, it's the sort of thing you would expect out of a five-year-old. If you told a five-year-old you're only allowed to take one piece of chocolate, and you turned around and the five-year-old had taken five pieces of chocolate, and the five-year-old said to you, well, I did only take one piece, I just took it five times, you would understand that the five-year-old is just a five-year-old. But that's basically the government's argument about the meaning of limited times. They say, it's a limited time, it's always a limited time, so long as they just extend it for a certain number of years, and they're free to extend it as many times as they want, so long as each extension is, quote, limited. And this gives them the power to enact, as Peter Yazzie from American University calls it, a perpetual term on the installment plan, and that's basically been Congress's practice for the past 40 years. Now, our claim is the Constitution means something more than the permanent perpetual terms on the installment plan, and that the Supreme Court should strike this law down on the principle that while it's completely appropriate for Congress to set the terms prospectively for new works, there's no constitutional justification for extending the term of existing works. And the reason is the whole purpose behind the Copyright Clause is to create an incentive for people to produce something new. And one thing we know about incentives is that they operate prospectively. No matter what we do, Hawthorne will not produce anything more, or George Gershwin will not publish another great work. So retrospective extensions do not produce new creativity. They just give existing copyright holders a longer term to collect monopoly rents from their copyrights. So we're filing this lawsuit. We filed this lawsuit. The Supreme Court agreed to hear the case in February. And in October, October 9th, the court will hear arguments, oral arguments about the case, and by sometime next year, they will decide whether, when the framers sent limited times, they meant limited times.
Well, this seems to be a case really of extraordinary importance, not to blow it out of proportion.
Well, I mean, obviously we think it's important because if the Supreme Court clearly establishes that the limits of the Constitution mean what they plainly say, then the ability of these special interests to use Congress to expand their control over the future of our culture will be restrained. And so I think this is it's a little bit indirect, but it will establish a very important principle if we win. And if your callers are interested, there's a website called, you just go to www.eldred.cc, and you'll see the website with all the documents about the case. And there's also a link there where you can get a free bumper sticker that says Free the Mouse, which is reference to the poor Mickey Mouse who has been controlled for longer time than most political prisoners because of the perpetual extension of existing copyrights.
All I can say is thank God we have a Supreme Court that's committed to truth and justice over partisan politics and
self-interest. Well, you know, you can say that, and many people hear that somewhat cynically, but I actually think that in this context, this type of case, the Supreme Court has consistently done the right thing. And that's because they aren't lobbied by people from Hollywood. They do have a vision of the long term. They do typically try to invoke and protect the principles the framers established. And on this case, the framers are on our side. The originalists should be on our side because the framers believed in limiting monopolies, not giving Congress the power perpetually to extend them.
You know, Larry, we've only got about a minute left, and I would like to just turn the course a little bit. A lot of people always ask me, who actually regulates the Internet then? And the group called ICON or ICANN is the name that's often invoked. Could you tell us just in a minute or so who ICANN is, what they do, who else is regulating the Internet we should know about?
Well, in my view, the most important regulation of the Internet is the very architecture or technology of the Internet. That's what controls what you can do and what you can't do. Now, ICANN is an organization that was established in part by the United States government to control who had what rights to domain names. So if you want lessig.com, you would go to ICANN and you would go to a registrar who was regulated by ICANN to get access to lessig.com. Now, this is a board. It's a private nonprofit corporation incorporated in California that basically controls policies related to those domain names. And it's been increasingly criticized because in its regulation of those policies, many people think it's also trying to impose regulations about copyright law or that help.
Larry, I think I should have given you more time because I hear the band tuning up in the background, which means we've got to get out of the studio. I'd love to get you back on after the Supreme Court case, however it goes, to talk about that again, if that's okay.
I'd be happy to.
And we'd like to thank you very much, Larry Lessig, author of Code and Other Laws of Cyberspace and the Future of Ideas, for being our guest today on Media Matters. I'll be back next week with Nancy Snow. Please join us then. Thank you very much.